Welcome everyone to what may be the penultimate Yeshaya class for now. What may be, we may have one more after that, June 30th, we'll see. Paul, I did see your email, and others have discussed the possibility of having some kind of mini-series that addresses at least the themes in the remainder of the book. We'll see. That's what I'm willing to say right now. But we are at the start of chapter 39, and theoretically we should be launching into chapter 39, but we're not, because in preparing chapter 39 I noticed a couple of sources that I had missed that I think add texture to what we've already been discussing, and so I want to go back to them. If you take a look on your sheet, and hopefully everybody has the sheet, we're good? Okay. So, if you take a look at the first source, this is a passage in the Talmud in Sanhedrin, and you can see page 104a. It goes back to our discussion about Chizkiyahu asking for a sign. And you may recall that we asked, how could Chizkiyahu, who is so righteous, who seems to have faith in God, how could he ask for a sign that he's going to be healed? And we gave a couple of three different explanations, all showing that it's not, in fact, a failing in faith. Whether it was because he thought that he wasn't worthy and therefore God wasn't going to help him, whether it was because he thought that the fig thing was just a way to make him feel better but not that he was actually going to be healed. Well, if you take a look at this passage from the Talmud, you actually find the argument that no, it was indeed a failing, and in fact it was part of a cascade of failures. Take a look at this. Remember that when Chizkiyahu first becomes ill and he prays to God, he says, "Hatov be'enecha asisi," I did what was good in your eyes. He defends himself. So the Talmud says, okay, that's problem number one. That's not how you deal with things. If you have you know, something and you're pleading with God, then what you're supposed to do is say, God, I don't know what I did wrong, but I apologize for whatever it was, and I would certainly like to correct my ways. Not, God, I've done exactly what you asked. I don't know what your problem is. So if you take a look at source number one, the Talmud says, "Bishvil v'hatov be'inecha asisi," because he said, I did what was good in your eyes, ma'os. The result of that was his question of what sign, meaning his request for a sign. It was a consequence of the initial flaw revealed by saying, I've done everything I'm supposed to do, that develops into a point where he says, you know what, I don't trust. Maybe I'm not going to have a son. Maybe I'm not going to get better. And bishvil ma'os, and then as a consequence of asking for a sign, it got worse. Nachrim achlu al shulchano. Foreigners ate off of his table. Meaning, what we're going to read about in chapter 39, that he gets visitors who are Babylonian/Assyrian, we'll talk about who they are, and he brings them into his home, and he has them, he shows them all of his great stuff, and so on. So this is a sin in its own right, as we're going to have to discuss. And the Talmud says, "Bishvil shenochrim achlu al shulchano garam golus lebanav," because they ate off his table, therefore, he caused his children to go into exile, which is what's brought at the end of the chapter, when he's told that as a consequence of the way that he dealt with these visitors, his children will be exiled. And it supports the idea of Chizkiyah. The Chizkiyah who's mentioned here in source number one is not Chizkiyahu the king. It is a sage from the Mishnah's time named Chizkiyah. Happens to be that he's quoted in a source that makes that really confusing. Nonetheless, Messiah Chizkiyah, this supports Chizkiyah. The Amar Chizkiyah, because he said, "Kol hamizamein oved avodazara l'soch beiso u'mishamish alav gorem galus labanav." You invite an idolater into your home and you act as his servant, you're going to cause your children to go into exile, and that's the punishment that is brought upon him. He should not have hosted them as he did. Yes, Susan.
But why should the children suffer, the innocent, when you're saying because...
So we'll talk about that. We're not there yet. We're not there yet, but when we get to it in the chapter, when we get to that that statement, we'll have to deal with it. But you should realize, this ain't new. Meaning the idea that when somebody does something wrong, there is a cascading effect on their descendants is unfortunately not new, and there are a range of different approaches to it, and we'll see that reflected in the discussion when we get to that point. Carla, you were going to say? No? Okay. So that's, I thought that was interesting because, you know, it's unlike what I had said earlier that, you know, that we can interpret the sign as not being negative. And frankly, the commentators all gave ways to do that. It wasn't my own invention. But the Talmud here is saying not so fast. It reads it as a negative. Don't be surprised by the deviation between the approaches of the commentators versus the approach of the Gemara. That happens fairly frequently. Those who learned Shmuel with me will recall that when the nation comes to Shmuel and says, we want to have a king, and Shmuel, of course, protests. At one point, he says to them, you know what your king is going to do? Your king is going to take your children and make them his slaves. Your children is going to take all your property. Your king, he's going to take all your property, and so on. He says all these terrible things that are going to happen from the king. The commentators generally read that as a warning about the types of kings they're going to have. Not that kings are supposed to do this, but your kings are going to do this. But when you read the Talmud, you actually find a strong view presented that no, this is actually, your king will have these powers. This is what kings are licensed to do. So you find that where you'll have a stream of approaches in the commentators that is different from the approaches of the... commentator saying one thing and the Talmud giving you a different approach altogether. Okay. That's number one. Number two was for this Maharsha in source number two. And 2 points that he makes. The Maharsha here, Rabbi Shmuel, I think, not Shlomo, I think it's Shmuel, Rabbi Shmuel Edels, in what, if I remember correctly, was the 17th century. Someone who's listening on the audio is going to correct me at some point, but I think it was 17th century. He wrote commentary to the Talmud in two forms. One, commentary on legal issues, called Chidushei Halachot, and the other, commentary on passages that have nothing to do with law at all, like this one, about the story of Chizkiyahu, called Chidushei Agadot. So both of those get published together in the back of a standard Vilna edition of the Talmud. So here he's talking about, well, he talks about two different things. One, the dragging of Ahaz's body ordered by Chizkiyahu, right? Chizkiyahu has his father's body taken for burial through the streets instead of being carried in an honorable way. It's dragged along the ground. And then number two, the extra 10 hours of sunlight that God gives as part of this sign for Chizkiyahu. And he says two things that we had not seen before. So take a look at source number two. We discussed how the Talmud knows that Chizkiyahu had Ahaz's body dragged. We noted that the text in Tanakh talks about a lack of honor for Ahaz when he is buried, as opposed to the way that other kings are honored when they are buried. But the assumption I made when I read that passage is that Chizkiyahu was doing this to make a statement to the nation, right? That Ahaz, who rejected Yeshaya's counsel, is the old guard, and now we're getting rid of that. It is discarded in disgrace. That's why I had read that. But take a look at source number two. Sheniskatzer hayom biyom shemes Ahaz eser shaos. The day was abbreviated by 10 hours when Ahaz died. We talked about that. Kedei shelo yehi nispad, so that he would not be eulogized. Lo yumis ablan olav, and they wouldn't grieve for him. Davelis yom rishon de'oraisa, because the first day of grieving is very important. That there's a biblical idea of grieving on day one, which may not be the same for the rest of the week of Shiva. So the first day of grief is particularly important, and he is deprived of that. V'chol zeh, why did God deprive Ahaz of people's mourning? Sheyihya lo kapara, to atone for him. Because the Talmud in the 6th chapter in Sanhedrin says, Kol mi shelo nispad kahalacha mechaperin lo. If a person is not eulogized properly as they deserve, that is kapara. That is atonement. Rebecca, I see your hand. Hang on for 1 second. that is an atonement. And then he goes on to say, the same thing is true. When he was buried, when Achaz was buried, when they brought him to burial, it was bebizayon, with disgrace, kedesha yellow kapara, so that it would act as an atonement for him. So the Maharsha says that what Chizkiyahu did to his father by having the body dragged that way through the street instead of being carried in honor was actually an attempt to atone, to help his father to gain atonement. I thought that was fascinating. Rebecca, now you're on the phone. I don't know if it's a good time.
No, I'm on the phone because Rana can't get in.
She's not on the right. Please tell her she's not on the right Zoom.
I sent her.
That's the first point of the Maharsha, is that the Chizkiyahu is having the body dragged to atone for his father. And then the other point, we asked the question about that sign that Chizkiyahu was the sign that Chizkiyahu was given, that the sun should go back 10 hours, and we wanted to know why that sign in particular. And most of the commentators did not offer an explanation. Only I think it was Abarbanel said that it's because a person's life is compared to a shadow, so by having the shadow retreat, it means you get more time. That was his explanation. However, look at the Maharsha. He says, "V'nisarech hayom eser sha'os b'yom shnisrapei Chizkiyahu mecholyo." On the day Chizkiyahu was healed, you had an extra 10 hours of daylight. V'hu al shem shashemesh merapei, because the sun heals. And this is an idea you find a lot in the Talmud, the idea that sunlight has curative possibilities. So that's why he gives him this sign. It's not really a sign. It's actually part of the healing itself, or it's a sign of healing. However, you're going to read that comment in the Maharsha. But I thought that was also worth noting. Okay. Rebecca, did she have it? Yeah? Okay, great. Thank you. All right. So that brings us to start chapter 39. Chapter 39, when you look at it, you think, ha, this is going to be easy. Look at it, it's tiny. But no, not so much. Yes, it's tiny, 8 sentences in all, but there's a lot going on here. So I'm just hopeful that we finish it by the end of June. That's my goal. So let's see what happens there. All right, and Brona is here. Yay. Worked out. Welcome. Thank you, Rebecca. So, the opening 2 sentences give us a scene in which it appears a Babylonian king sends a letter and gift to Chizkiyahu, and Chizkiyahu displays his wealth to his visitors. Let's take a look at it as described here in Yeshaya, and then we're going to compare it with the accounts in Malachim and in Divrei Hayamim, and then we'll get to Carla's question. Are you having trouble hearing? All right, hang on 1 second. Better? Better? Okay. So then we'll get to Carla's question about whether these are really Babylonians at all, because that's something that she's been waiting very patiently for in the conversation.
I found the answer.
Oh, that's all right. We have a lot to discuss. If you think we're just going to have one answer, you've got another thing coming.
You made me into a Chizkiyahu and Mirudach Baladan junkie, so I'm going to learn.
Okay, good. We've got a lot to talk about. So let's read it in Yeshaya first. Chapter 39, sentence 1. Ba'ez ha'hi, at that time, Shalach Merodach Baladan ben Baladan, that's a great name, by the way, Melech Bavel, Sfarim u'mincha el Chizkiyahu. At that time. What time? That time. I don't know. That time, presumably by default, is right after the events of chapter 38, in which Chizkiyahu was healed. Right? At that time, after he was healed, Merodach Baladan ben Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Sfarim, letters, Umincha, and a gift, to Chizkiyahu, Vayishma Kichala Vayechazak. He heard that he had been ill, and that then he had been strengthened. Vayismach alayim Chizkiyahu, and Chizkiyahu was so happy to have visitors. All this time he's been in quarantine. Look, I got company. Vayareim es beis nichoso, and he showed them beis nichoso. We're going to come back to those words because I don't know what they mean. Es hakesef, v'es hazahav, v'es habesamim, v'es hashemen hatov, the silver, the gold, the spices, the good oil, v'es kol beis kelav, and also the whole store of his utensils, implements, whatever those are, v'es kol asher nimtza be'otzrosav, and everything in his stores, lo hayadavar asher lo heram chizkiyo beveiso uvechol memshalto, there was nothing that Chizkiyahu did not show them, not in his home and not in his entire kingdom. Everything is up for them to see.
Your microphone's turned up.
Unfortunately, sorry.
Fine here.
That's good. I'm glad it's fine there. Should be fine somewhere. Now, unfortunately, my computer is in the habit these days of deciding to update its search index while I'm on Zoom. Everything else, I figured out what to do. Okay, should be better now. So, reading what we just read, right? Reading Chizkiyahu's display of everything for these people. Reading how happy he was. Reading that they sent him, gifts and letters and all of that. It's a really interesting story, right? Aside from some of the factual questions, like, who is this? And, you know, what the question of why he's visiting, what exactly motivated him to visit, is not clear, at least to me. But overall, we're going to have to launch back into a question that we've discussed before, which is, what does Yeshayahu think relations between Jews and their neighbors ought to be? What is we already know Yeshayahu is not a fan of alliances, that's for sure. But can we get more sophisticated with that? So I'm jumping now into Sefer Melachim, the Book of Kings. I'm jumping to source number 4, where I brought you the text in Melachim. Melachim Bet, chapter 20, sentences 12 to 13. Ba'eis ha'hi, so far so good. At that time, Shalach Berodach Baladan ben Baladan Melech Bavel Sfarim Umenchal Chizkiyahu. This king, again, king of Babylon, sent, again, letters and a gift to Chizkiyahu. Ki shama ki chala Chizkiyahu. Because he heard that Chizkiyahu was ill. Now, first of all, don't get hung up on Berodach and Merodach. Everybody agrees it's the same person. It's just that the two sounds, the b and the m, are generated in the same way, and they get conflated with each other. He probably had this issue in school all the time when he was a kid, and people were struggling with this whole Merodach Balad and Ben Balad and things. So some people said Berodach, some people said Merodach. They probably called him worse things in school, if I had to guess. So don't get hung up on that piece of it. The piece that is interesting to me is here I have a better understanding of why he visited. What was his reason for visiting? Can't hear you. He had been sick. Right. He heard he was sick. It sounds like, as Carla says, Bikur Cholim. He's looking after him. It doesn't say he heard that he got better. It says he heard that he got sick. And so he says...
It says that in Yeshayahu also.
Is it the same thing in Yeshayahu? Take a look again. And he heard. It almost sounds like he sent for a different reason, and once he sent, he found out that Chizkiyahu had been sick and also had gotten better, which was not mentioned in Melachim. You follow? And then you get the rest of the sentence, and instead of saying Vayismach, that Chizkiyahu was happy, it says Vayishma Aleihem. He listened to them, and then he showed them all those wonderful things. All the wealth and all the other things we'll have to talk about. But that's your second version. But Why stop there? Take a look in Divrei HaYamim, in Chronicles, in source number 5. Picking up after God saves the Jews from Sancheirev, saves Yerushalayim at any rate, from Sancheirev. Vayosha Hashem et Yechizkiyahu ves Yoshvei Yerushalayim miyad Sancheirev melech Ashur miyad kol vayinalei misaviv. God saves them from everybody. Things are wonderful. He saved Yerushalayim. V'rabim mevi'im enchal Hashem Yerushalayim. Many brought gifts to Yerushalayim. Not just these Babylonians. Many brought gifts to Yerushalayim, and they brought migdanot, delicacies, to Chizkiyahu Melech Yehuda. Vayinasei le'enei kol ha'goyim me'acharechein. He was elevated in the eyes of all of the nations. Bayamim ahem, and then Chizkiyahu got sick. Right? And he davened, and Hashem gave him a sign, right? Divrei HaYamim is very brief. We've talked about that in this regard. Velo kigmul alav heshiv Chizkiyahu. But Chizkiyahu did not respond to God in keeping with what God had done for him. We've talked about this. We talked about last time the whole thing about not singing. But he did not respond in kind. Kigavalibo, his heart was elevated. He became arrogant. Vayihi alav ketzev val Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. God was angry at him and at Yehuda and Yerushalayim. And Chizkiyahu had wealth. Dot, dot, dot. It goes on to describe all the different kinds of wealth. And then you get Pasuk Lamed, sentence 30, still in source number 5. V'hu Yechizkiyahu sasam es motzam mimei gichon. This is the end of Chizkiyahu's life in the description in Divrei HaYamim. So we get a little bit of a summary of what he had done. So Chizkiyahu sealed up the Gihon waters, right? Well, that was when he was worried about the invasion. Vayashrim lamata ma'arava le'ir David. He had them go downward west to Ir David, or west of Ir David. He was very successful. And then you get Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31. V'chein b'melitzei sarei bavel ha'mishalchim alav lidrosh ha'mofes asher haya ba'aretz. When Bavel sent to know about the sign that occurred in the land. So now it's not about his illness at all. Now they want to know about the sign. Azavo ha'elokim l'nasoso l'das kol bilvavo. God abandoned him to test him, to know everything in his heart, and then you say, and everything else you want to know about it, go read Yeshaya and go read Malachi. That's the last sentence. So, now I'm genuinely confused. I have different records of why they came to visit. Right? They, this one doesn't even talk about him showing them all of his wealth. It doesn't say. It just says God abandoned him to test him to know what was in his heart. What in the world is going on? So let's see if we can get the story straight first. If we can get the story straight, then maybe we can also understand more about moral of the story. So first of all, as I asked before, who this? Who's this guy Merodach Baladan? Take a look at source number 3, and you start to see why it's a problem. Go back to source number 3. From Melachim Bet, Kings 2. Vayavo melech Ashur mi Bavel umikuta umeyavo machmas farvayim vayeshev vayoshev be'abiyarei shomron tachas. Sorry, Vayave, not Vayavo. Vayave, Melech Ashur mi Bavel, etc. Vayoshev ba'arei Shomron tachas b'nei Yisrael. When the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom, we've discussed this before, they exiled the 10 tribes and brought in other people to live there. We talked about that in the beginning of Yeshaya. We talked about that when we learned Ezra. That's how you get the Samaritans, who are also known as the Kutim because of the word Kuta right here in the sentence. The Assyrians, when they conquered the northern kingdom, brought in other populations to live there. But look at the first place from which they brought people. They brought people from Babel, from Babylon. Meaning the Assyrians are in charge of Babylon. So what Babylonian king was this? There's no Babylonian king, there's an Assyrian king. That's one problem. Second problem, again, is why are you visiting? It's really, really not clear as to how to read this. And by the way, what's with the oil? Silver, gold, spices, oh, and good oil. Like, what, they were to saute something? Like, what exactly was that about? So, here's our story. We said that the Assyrians are in charge of Babylon at this point. That seems to be fairly clear. You could argue that, nonetheless, Merodach Baladan is Babylonian by looking at his name. The name Merodach is actually a Babylonian god, right? I'm sure you've heard people who claim that the name Mordechai in Megillat Esther is linked to that. That's a discussion for another time. But take a look at source number 6, in which you find Merodach mentioned as a Babylonian god in Tanakh, a verse from Yirmiyahu, from Jeremiah, the part I underlined. Nilkedah Bavel, Bavel is conquered. Hovish, Baal, Baal is dismayed, or embarrassed, ashamed. Chas Merodach, and Merodach either trembles or is crushed. I didn't look to see how it's translated, but it's not important. The point is that Bavel, as well as their god Baal, as well as their god Merodach, are described here as being crushed, and the point for us is that Merodach is identified as a Babylonian god. So you might say, I don't care if Assyria is in charge of Babylon, Merodach is Babylonian. But it's probably not adequate as a proof that Merodach is Babylonian, because when Assyrian kings conquered Babylon, they absorbed their gods. Right? Think of when the Romans conquered the Greeks and they absorbed so much of Greek culture. So that happens here as well. So in other words, it would not be unusual for an Assyrian king to have a Babylonian god in his name. So, I am trying to put out there the following idea. Assyrians are in control of Babylon. The Babylonian king who came to visit was Assyrian. Why in the world would the Assyrians want to send anything to Chizkiyahu? I mean, maybe a hand grenade. What? Sorry? Shoshana, are you talking to me? I don't understand. Oh, a spy. So that indeed is a possibility we're going to get to. The possibility that this was an espionage mission. That's indeed one possibility. What else?
Number 12.
Sorry?
What you write it?
Oh, no, don't, you're not allowed to reference what I put on the source sheet. What I put on the source sheet later is for me to get to. You have to bring your own sources. Yes, Susan?
Could it be possible that, isn't this just after he conquered the Babylonians? So he's trying, he doesn't want us Chizkiyahu to turn around and assault him or the Jews to, that he's there for trying to pacify.
So that the Assyrians conquered the Babylonians and now want to pacify Chizkiyahu? They just invaded and attacked Yerushalayim. They destroyed the northern kingdom. They destroyed most of the southern kingdom. They're not sending you presents.
But didn't Chizkiyahu just win the battle?
No, Chizkiyahu didn't win anything. They woke up in the morning and the armies were dead.
They might want to expand now because they have, you know, now they want the east, the west, the south.
So they're making nice to Chizkiyahu. Interesting. I haven't seen that idea suggested. But this is only one problem. We have more problems before things get better.
Is there a connection with the fact that he showed them all his riches?
I mean, for sure we're going to have to go there. Whether that's what they wanted, you know, from him, whether he was doing it because they wanted is an interesting question. Was that his own decision? Or was that what they were looking for? That would make this sound not like the type of mission where you send a letter and a gift, but the type of mission where you send a lot of armed men. And you say, show me what's in your storehouse. That's not really what this sounds like, but keep it in mind as a possibility. The second...
Is there a possibility that they want to expand? I'm kind of combining what's been said. But you don't always have to expand through warfare. They've seen what Asherah has done. Does Chizkiyahu want to go up against him? I mean, that's the question. And so he could be trying to sort of come in the back door and convince Chizkiyahu it doesn't pay to put up a fight against
him. So are you saying this is Assyrian or Babylonian?
or when they...
Okay. You're saying that it's Assyria that's sending this.
Right.
Okay. So maybe is there another way to get in? Could well be. But we have another problem. Merodach Baladan isn't alive at this point. Or he may be alive, but he's not in power. Meaning, we have Assyrian records of Merodach Baladan. He's not new to us. And according to the records that we have, he actually flees from Babylon for the last time between the year 703 before the Common Era and 700 before the Common Era. The Assyrian attack on Jerusalem appears to take place at approximately the year 701 before the Common Era, which means it's very, very tight to think that this happened. Again, in the year 701 before the Common Era, you have the events we just read about, the Assyrian assault on Jerusalem. In the year 700 BCE, Merodach Baladan is driven out of Babylon by the Assyrians. So, you have a few months in there when this could have happened, but the timing is tight. We're going to talk about that. I'm not leaving that. I'm just saying that's a second problem, is when is this happening? So I'm going to offer you three classic approaches, and I'm going to modify one of them to offer something slightly different. First of all, Radak's approach. Radak says this is an Assyrian king. For real. This is an Assyrian king. Why in the world would an Assyrian king show up? So Radak doesn't say it, but I'm going to show you sources that do. Shoshana? Shoshana, you were saying? Okay. No problem. So if you take a look at source number 7, Radak says, first of all, he brings you the thing about Barodach, Merodach, don't worry about that, you say tomato, I say potato, or whatever it is. And then he says, Ubaladan, hu shem kinui nismach la'aviv shayashmo Baladan. Baladan is a descriptive linked to his father, who was named Baladan, but that's not his name. What is his actual name? Vizeh melech esar chadon. Esar Hadon is the king after Sancheirev over Assyria. The Assyrians ruled over Babylon in the time of Sancheirev. Sancheirev's successor, Esar Hadon, is an Assyrian king who rules over Babylon, and he is the one who comes to visit, or sends messengers, I should say, to visit. But why? Radak doesn't say. However, that's what we have a Gemara for. Take a look at source number 8. Presumably Radak has this Gemara in mind when he says that. Source number 8, Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, English to the top of the next side. I'm going to skip the Hebrew and just read my English aloud just in the interests of time. The Gemara asks a question. You're telling me that it's a product of Chizkiyahu falling ill and recovering. That's the way it wants to read the text. It says, why did that lead to sending letters and a gift? Because Chizkiyahu fell ill and recovered, he sent him letters and a gift? To seek out the wonder that happened in the land. That's why they did it. The Divrei Hayamim verse, in other words, the verse in Chronicles. That's why they sent. For Abba Yochanan said, the day Ahaz died was just 2 hours long, the whole thing with the 10 hours being restored. That's the piece that I quoted to you in the beginning of our class today. Merodach said to them, what is this? What happened to the 10 hours? He said to the people in his homeland, he said. They said, Chizkiyahu was ill and recovered. He said, there's someone like this and I shouldn't send him a greeting? Ha! If he can pull that off, I want to be on good terms with this fellow. And so that's why the Assyrians are doing it. It's because of the miracle. The Medrash on Shir HaShirim in source number 9 goes even further with it. And I'm not going to read it aloud. I'm just going to explain what's in it and you can read it for yourself. I'm a little confused about the timetable they float there. But basically they say that he was a worshiper of the sun, this fellow Merodach. And he overslept because of the 10-hour thing, and didn't realize that he hadn't missed the day. He was very angry at his men, and they explained to him that, no, this happened by the Jewish God, and he's so impressed when they explained to him the powers of this Jewish God that he says, I got to send letters and a gift. this is something I have to know about. So according to Radak, it's about the miracle. That's what drives them to show up. And in fact, it's the... Hang on, Carla. Hi, I see you. In fact, it's the Assyrian king, not the Babylonian king. Now, you'll ask me, why doesn't it say the king of Assyria? Why does it say the king of Babylon? So here, I just referenced for you in source number 10, two verses that we read when we learned the book of Ezra. Right? Rebecca, Joyce, Alina, Ellen, were you there when we did Ezra? You were? Okay. I was there. Rena, I think you were there when we did Ezra. Yeah, okay. So you remember this already. I can skip source number 10. Source number 10 refers you to two verses in Ezra. In the first of them, it's Cyrus being described as the king of Babylon, even though he was a Persian king who had actually conquered it. And in the next one that I quoted you, Darius is called the king of Assyria. Because again, he had conquered Assyria. So often, not often, I don't know, at times, kings will take the name of the population they conquered, particularly where it's useful to them. So for example, the Cyrus Cylinder. Right, remember that? The Cyrus Cylinder has Cyrus's decree to the Babylonians, telling them that their god has authorized him to rebuild their temple, and he's the rightful conqueror, and so on. He identifies himself as king of Babylon. So here, the Assyrian who conquered Babylon is known as the king of Babylon. Why would the text use that? I understand now that he can be called that way, but why would you want to specifically do that? I wonder if it isn't hinting, because this chapter is going to lead to the Babylonian destruction of the temple. By the time we're done with this chapter, we will have a promise that the temple is going to be destroyed, and it's going to be by the Babylonians. And so I wonder if that's not why we characterize it as the king of Babylon here specifically. Carla, you've been waiting very patiently. Thank you.
I think we learned earlier, a few weeks ago, that the miracle was Ba'aret only and not beyond the borders.
So that was exactly the debate. We talked about all the different views as to where this miracle took place, and some said it was localized, and others said, no, it's everywhere. And Radak is of the view, like this Gemara, that in fact, and like Divrei HaYamim, frankly, that it's beyond. But we will see other views coming up momentarily. So don't worry, we got all views. But that's your first take. What's happening here is an Assyrian king who heard about the miracle and says, I got to know about this. I don't care that we just fought a war and I lost. I need to know about this. Okay, that's one. Malbim gives me a second approach. This is a Babylonian king who is allied with the Assyrians. And Malbim has a lot to say here, but I thought it was all worthwhile. And so I actually translated a lot of it on your sheet in source number 11. It's a lot of text, but it's worth it to get his perspective on what's going on here. He is also going to give us, along the way, his perspective on what Chizkiyahu did wrong. So I'm not going to go into everything he has to say, because I don't want to, you know, run into next week's stuff. But let's see what he has here. I'm going to read out my English translation. God performed this great wonder, the likes of which had not happened since the time of Yoshua ben Nun, right? Stopping the sun. Not so that Chizkiyahu would trust that he would be healed and ascend to the house of God. He says, why is God stopping the sun? Just to make Chizkiyahu feel like God is going to heal me? God would not perform such a great deed for such a small purpose, right? We asked that question in chapter 38. We said, why would God do that just to show him that he's going to get into the temple, he's going to be healed? No. Even without this wonder, even without the miracle, it will be known to him on the third day the affliction was healed. He said, how do I know? I'm going to go to the temple of God on the third day. But this had a great purpose and general benefit for the entire nation who had been banished to the ends of the earth by Sanherib. God wanted them to have a bit of support, and lest these banished sheep be lost among the many wolves. Therefore, he performed this great wonder for them such that the ends of the earth would see it and be in awe. And this is, again, following the view that everybody sees what happened. and their neighbors around them would tremble before them. And these banished people, their hearts were strengthened in God. Some of them even returned to their land beneath Chizkiyahu's protection with none to oppose them. Meaning there's an idea found in the prophet Yirmiyahu that actually some of the 10 tribes came back. It was in Yeshaya also we had a reference to it. He goes on here to refer to it. For all the residents of the land feared them as it was prophesied earlier. Also, if they would have merited it, then they would have had the general ingathering via Chizkiyahu. Mashiach would have come, as I have mentioned, for the sin mentioned here was what let them down. That's why it didn't work out. So Malvin is of the belief that God created this miracle not to reassure Chizkiyahu, don't worry, you're getting better. It was to give the Jews a leg up among the nations of the world, so that people will see them and be amazed and be respectful and will not harm them. That's the way that Malbim reads the story. Therefore, even the king of Babel, of Babylon, was awakened to seek the cause of this wonder. Not out of love of Chizkiyahu and his nation did he send letters and a gift to him. But now watch what happens. Watch what Malbim does. Malbim loves political intrigue. For Chizkiyahu himself said they came from a distant land. They weren't close. It's clear they didn't have any connection with Israel until now. The opposite. There were spies in the land. Shoshana, 2 points. For the kingdom of Babel were close and beloved with the kingdom of Assyria. They were generally one kingdom, as is known. And they grieved for the fall of their brothers. This is a very different view of international relations in that time. The Babylonians and the Assyrians, they're close. They love it. And now the Babylonians are angry. Look what you did to the Assyrians. From that time they had designs on Israel. And they acted cleverly, sending letters and a gift as a strategy to determine the wonder and its root, to know the sources of the strength of this nation with the help of God who told the sun to stop for them. You follow? And then Malbim is going to continue, but I'm going to hold off on his continuation until we get to it. But Malbim is going to say that's why it's so terrible that Chizkiyahu doesn't talk about what God did. Chizkiyahu makes it all about himself and his illness, and it undermines the fact that God was willing to do such a miracle on behalf of the nation. So Malbim's read is that this is a Babylonian king who already is angry about what was done to the Assyrians, and they want to get to the bottom of this wonder they heard about. That's our second take. But then you get the third take. And the third take, I think, is the most realistic from the perspective of history and the way nations worked in that region at that time. You're right, says this third view. The Assyrians controlled Babylon. But let's think for a minute. When the Babylonians controlled the land of Israel, before they destroyed the temple, who was immediately in charge of the land? Who ran the show? Sorry?
Allah.
What?
Allah.
No, not Eliyahu.
Gedaliah.
Oh, Gedaliah? Well, that's after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But you're right, there was Gedaliah, but there was also, Alina, you're going to say? Zedekiah, correct. And before you had Yechoniah, right? The Babylonians were of the habit of appointing puppet kings who would pay them tribute. And it wasn't just the Babylonians. That's the way you did things. Who wanted to take over a land and then have to worry about managing it themselves? It's a lot easier. Let them run themselves as long as they pay you tribute and don't rebel. Now, mind you, that script didn't always work. But that's the idea. And that's what the Assyrians did here. Sure, Merodach Baladan can call himself king of Babylon if he likes, as long as he knows who's buttering his bread. That's the idea. So, the thing is, if you're Merodach Baladan, what are you looking to do? What opportunity are you looking for? Oh, come on. You want a chance to rebel against the Assyrians.
And find loyal allies.
Yeah, you want allies. This is the whole story that we went through earlier in the book, where Yeshaya tells Chizkiyahu, and before him tells Ahaz, don't go looking for allies, remember? You're not supposed to? That's exactly what's going on here. This is the view of Ralbag. This is the view of Abarbanel. And it fits with the chronology brought by Encyclopedia Mikra'it in its discussion of Merodach Baladan. Take a look at source number 12. I didn't bring you all the text of Abarbanel and Ralbag because they can write for a very, very long time. They write longer than Malbim does. So if you take a look at source number 12, Ralbag says, Abba Bishaya Sancheirav Moshel de Bavel, granted Sancheirav is ruler of Bavel, Babylon, Hine Hayasham Melech, there was a king there, Vayataha Sancheirav, he was beneath the control of Sancheirav, Vayanose Lomas Shana Bishana, he used to pay him annual tribute, Kichain Haya Minago im Kolam Lachim Shekhovesho Sam, because that's what the Assyrians did. That's number one. Number two, we read in Chronicles in Divrei Hayamim that a lot of people were bringing gifts to Chizkiyahu. Why? It was because they heard of the wonder, not stopping the sun, but the wonder she'asah Hashem b'chel melech Ashur. The defeat of the Assyrians. I told you this weeks ago. It's a long time ago already. You're not responsible. But the view of Ralbag was that the miracle itself, such as it was local. What was it that everybody heard about? The complete demolition of the Assyrian army. That's what they heard about. And the Babylonians, sitting in their land, think to themselves, whoa, that's an ally. Right? That's the take of Ralbag. Abarbanel is slightly different. He also thinks it's about an alliance against Assyria. He thinks it is also about the illness and the sign, though, where Ralbag does not. But that's the idea, is they're looking for allies. Now, the one thing that I would tweak in this is based on the Encyclopedia Mikra'it. If you take a look at source number 13, this is their history of these events. I should note, by the way, I've noted it from time to time before, but I'm noted again now. We're working with the years that standard historians use. Meaning, this is not the count of the destruction of the first temple found in Seder Olam. Seder Olam is going to move everything you're seeing here 160 or so years later. I'm not going into the whole discussion now of why, what, whatever. Just know that as you read this. So according to this historical count, in the year 729, this is source number 13, in the year 729 before the Common Era, Babylon surrenders to the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser at the hands of Merodach. Now, Merodach is himself a Babylonian. He convinces the Babylonians to surrender to the Assyrians. He's a smart man. Because now that he convinced them to surrender, he is well positioned for power in this new era. 7 years later, there's turmoil as there's turnover in the Assyrian kingdom. Sargon II becomes the Assyrian king. Merodach takes the opportunity to become king of Babylon. He gets enough support locally. He looks for neighbors who are going to support him. The Assyrians are not happy. In the year 710, Sargon attacks and he drives out Merodach. However, in the year 703, Merodach comes back because now King Sancheirav is rising in Assyria, more turmoil, and so he says, I'm back, and he becomes king in Babylon again. Approximately the year 701, the Assyrians attack Jerusalem after they've exiled the northern tribes, and then Sancheirav attacks Babylon, driving out Merodach for the last time in the year 700. I talked about this before. And then finally, Merodach dies in exile, apparently the year 694. So, Encyclopedia Mikra'it is really bothered by this. They say they can't believe that Merodach is sending a message and a delegation to Israel, to Jerusalem, in the year 700, in between the failed Assyrian attack and Merodach's own collapse. They can't believe that. They don't accept that. But But the problem with it, and I brought it for you in 14, but I got tired of translating and ran out of time. So I didn't translate it. So I'm going to explain it outside, but I wanted you to have the text in front of you. They have a separate problem. Their problem is not only the narrow chronological window. Their problem is also something we noted last time, which is Chizkiyahu doesn't have any silver and gold at this point. He may have some silver. He doesn't have any gold. He sent the gold to the Assyrians, right, as part of the bribe-slash-stall tactic when the Assyrians wanted to attack. So what do you mean he's showing gold? He doesn't have any gold. He's certainly not a potential ally for anybody. He's, you know, that land is destroyed. The northern kingdom is gone. The southern kingdom suffered the destruction of major fortresses in the rampage by the Assyrians before they got stopped at Yerushalayim. They're not in any position to help anybody. So Encyclopedia Mikra'it is really bothered by this and ultimately comes to the conclusion that the visit by Merodach must have been before Sancheirib attacked Jerusalem. Which is clearly not what our text says. It's Ba'eis Ha'i, at that time. That's their view. But I think there is a possibility you can offer that solves their problem. Number one, number one, in terms of the wealth issue, he does have spoils. His spoils came from all those dead Assyrian soldiers. Right? That's something we're going to see. We didn't see it yet, but it's going to show up in a medrash that I brought you in source number 20. So that'll be next week. God willing, we'll see the medrash say that of course he has wealth. Number two, you're going to say to me the land was all destroyed by the Assyrian invasion. What good is he? Yeah, but that's because you don't believe in miracles. Right, that's because the Encyclopedia Mikra'it is a secular work. They don't necessarily think that a miracle happened here. If, on the other hand, I am a reader of the text, I believe that there was some kind of sign, whether it was global or not, for Chizkiyahu. There was the miraculous destruction of the Assyrian army. That's good enough to make the Babylonians think there's a potential ally here. So I think it actually works well. I'm not so troubled by it. I think that's exactly what happened. And to me, that also supports what we said last time about the criticism of Chizkiyahu for not singing Shira, right? Not singing to God. Because here you have the Babylonians show up and say, we heard about all these wonderful things God did for you. We heard that he destroyed the Assyrians. Right? He destroyed the Assyrian army. And Chizkiyahu doesn't say, yeah, look at all this gold. God gave this to us from them. Instead he says, look at all my gold. It's about me. And that's the mistake. And that's his failure. That's a way to read the story, and it fits, I think. The chronology is still a little tight in terms of it being before Merodach is driven out, but it fits the logic of him approaching us for an alliance. So again, to sum up what we've said in this, three different approaches to what's happening here. Either an Assyrian king who's really impressed by news of the miracle, Radak / the Gemara and Medrash, or a Babylonian king allied with the Assyrians, that's Malbin, and they're there for an espionage mission. He wants to see what the story is. Or, number three, Ralbag of Barbanel, and Encyclopedia Mikra'it, this is somebody who is under the thumb of the Assyrians, and wants to get out from under the thumb, and thinks Chizkiyahu is a way to do that. And and in terms of when this happened, I think it can be after the invasion, and after the invasion is driven back, and the newfound wealth came from those soldiers he defeated. That's the those are the different options. Carla, you were going to say, or you're good? Okay, go further. Okay, so it's 2:28, but we lost a couple of minutes on the sound, so I want to just at least, yeah, Rebecca, you were going to say? No. Okay. So I just want to show you a little bit more about what's going on here with this display of wealth that Chizkiyahu offers. Take a look at source number 15. This is from Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. After he gains his great power and he has great wealth, the Queen of Sheba comes to visit him. This, as we've discussed on other occasions, is the height of Shlomo's reign. It's before everything goes bad, when he marries the political marriages and everything else deteriorates. But this is when he's at his height. So the Queen of Sheba, Malkat Sheva, in source number 15, sees Kol Chochmat Shlomo, all of the wisdom of Solomon, V'abayit Asher Bana, and the house he built, U'machal Shulchano, and the food at his table, U'moshav Abadav, and all his servants, U'mamad Mishartav, U'mabushayem, and the servants, and the clothing of the servants, and all of the offerings he brings in the house of God, and she's just wowed. Her breath is taken away. Literally, that's what it says. Lohaya ba'od ruach. It took her breath away. And she gives him a whole bunch of gifts, which I skipped here. And then Shlomo gave Malkat Sheva everything she wanted. Whatever it was that she wanted, he gave her, and she went home, she and her servants. So there's precedent for what Chizkiyahu did, but it's not the same. Because the language that we have, in our case, is more extreme than the language that you had there. The language that you had there was, yes, he gave whatever he asked, and she was bowled over by everything that she saw. But here, it describes in detail how he showed them everything. Kol Beit Kelav, Kol Asher Nitzav Ba'otrotav, Lo Haya Davar Asher Lo Haram. There's nothing that he withholds from them. It's more dramatic when Chizkiyahu does it, and he's going to be taken on the chin for having done so. It also says that he shows Beit Nichoto. Those who are working with translations, what does the word Nichoto mean? What do you have in sentence two? Not commentaries, just the translation itself. Susan?
Treasure house.
Treasure house. Okay. It's kind of vague. I mean, I don't know what the word Nichot means. That's my problem. This is an unusual word. So what we're going to start... So Chana gives one possible etymology, which is Yaakov sent spices. This is when Yosef is sold. The traders are carrying Nechot Utsri Valot, so these are spices. Nechot is spelled differently, it has an aleph in it, but it's still basically the same word, and so indeed that's going to be one of the views. But we're going to have to come back to this, so God willing, next time we're going to pick up here, trying to understand what Chizkiyahu showed them, and then we're going to look at why it is punished so harshly, and if we have time for it next week, we'll also see a passage in the Talmud which sees in this story itself the seeds for the rise of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar. How do you like that? There's also this very odd medrash, which maybe I'll bring you next time, I don't know, which says that Nebuchadnezzar was actually the son of the Queen of Sheba, which would tie all these stories together in a bow. All right, maybe we'll come to that at some point. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for your patience with my balky speaker. Maybe I'll figure that out for next time.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Rabbi.
Yeah.